From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Thailand's fugitive education minister arrested by soldiers after condemning coup. China's continuing response to violence in Xinjiang. China blames Vietnam for sinking near disputed oil rig. These stories and more on this Wednesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. A spokesman for Thailand's military says VOA that the influence of former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat is the fundamental problem that must be solved before power can be returned to a civilian government. That remark came Tuesday as the army continued its crackdown on dissent, arresting the education minister of the deposed government immediately after he held a news conference in Bangkok. VOA correspondent Steve Herman has more from the Thai capital.
Soldiers entered the Foreign Correspondents Club of Thailand and seized Chatharan Chaisung, one of the fugitive ministers from the ousted cabinet.
Make way. Give him a space. Give him a space.
Bye. Thank you all.
Chatharang had defied the junta's order to surrender under martial law. Speaking to journalists minutes before he was taken away, Chatharang insisted it was legitimate for anyone to peacefully demonstrate or speak out against the coup.
Coup d'etat is not a solution to the problems or conflicts in Thai society, but will make the conflicts even worse. It is also a great concern that if those with authority cannot handle the problems well, it may lead to violence and greater losses.
Chatharang, an ally of Thaksin Shinawat, who was deposed in a 2006 coup, disputed that the military intends to carry out true political reform. Rather, he said it intends to put a system into place, ensuring only those favored by the elite, the military, and the royalists will be able to govern the kingdom. Army Colonel Werachong Sukhanhapatipak, a spokesman for the National Council for Peace and Order, was asked during a VOA interview shortly after Chatharang's remark whether the junta believes the billionaire former prime minister's influence is the root cause of Thailand's troubles.
That is the main reason for that caused the fundamental problem of Thailand.
The coup leader, Army Chief Prayut Chan-o-cha, is now running not only the country's military, but all the instruments of government. Colonel Werachong says the military does not have a timetable for return to civilian rule and elections.
It depends on the situation. It depends on all conflict parties. If they cooperate, if they agree that, okay, let's take a break.
Former Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat, Thaksin's sister, who was brought to power after her party won a majority of the legislative seats in the 2011 election, was forced to resign May 7th as caretaker prime minister when a court ruled she and nine members of her cabinet had abused their power. Her successor as interim prime minister, Niwatamrong Bunsongpaisan, lost his job in last Thursday's coup. The military has carried out 19 coups or attempted overthrows of civilian governments since the end of the absolute monarchy in 1932. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Daybreak Asia continues to explore the brewing political battle in Hong Kong in the third and final interview of our series later in the program. China says it has detained five more people and seized nearly 2 tons of what it calls bomb-making material just 2 days after announcing a one-year security crackdown in the western Xinjiang region. Local governments and officials Tuesday said two explosive-producing sites were also destroyed in Monday's raid. Sunday, state media quoted authorities claiming to have caught more than 200 suspects from nearly 24 terror and religious extremist groups in May. Last week, the regional capital, Urumqi, was the scene of a marketplace attack that killed 43 people and wounded more than 90. On April 30th, two attackers set off explosives and slashed passengers at an Urumqi train station, killing one and wounding 79. On March 1st, 8 knife-wielding men attacked passengers at a train station in Yunnan province, killing 29 people in what state media described as China's 9/11. China has blamed the attacks on Uyghurs, a largely Muslim ethnic minority group that is native to Xinjiang. Uyghurs in China complain of religious and cultural discrimination. Senior resident fellow Michael Clark at Australia's Griffith Asia Institute told VOA's Victor Beatty the terrorists China is facing are likely radicalized Uyghurs, although outside groups cannot be discounted.
China has in the past simply labelled all violence and opposition in Xinjiang as being the result of terrorism, and in particular of the work of two organisations. The first is the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, and the second is the Turkestan Islamic Party. However, there has been little concrete proof that either of those organisations have carried out attacks within Xinjiang, although there is evidence that those two organisations do exist and are based in the tribal areas along the frontiers between Afghanistan and Pakistan.
This one-year security crackdown announced last week by China, this obviously represents what they considered a serious challenge to domestic tranquility.
The fact that they've launched an explicitly Xinjiang-specific, almost targeted campaign against terrorism and against religious extremism does suggest the seriousness with which the threat is taken. And in that context, in terms of the seriousness of the threat, we have to recall here that the latest events, I mean, since the Kunming attack on the 1st of March and then the first two Urumqi attacks and now this latest incident of arrests in Hotan sort of demonstrates an escalation in the level and potential scope of the threat to China's position in the region.
Why would China put a one-year cap on this security crackdown?
There is precedent in Xinjiang's recent past for this. Throughout the late 1990s, authorities instituted rolling yearly so-called strike hard campaigns that were directed against separatists and extremists. Yet the innovation, in a sense, is that it has been stated by the authorities that this is a nationwide campaign against terrorism.
Clark says the one-year security crackdown will likely not address what he calls the root causes of the violence, addressing the question of why elements of the Uyghur population have become radicalized. Ahmad Salah Hashim, Associate Professor of Strategic Studies at Singapore's Nanyang Technological University, says China's counter-terrorism response thus far has been inadequate.
When the violence started, they announced strike-hard policies and mixed with palliative measures like stating that they will implement economic and social development programs and integrate the Uyghur population more effectively and also deal with incidents sort of uncivility by PLA units and the PIP police units. But I think the outbreak, increased number of attacks, as well as the fact that they're not able to get much in the way of human intelligence about them, has really shaken them quite a bit.
Right now, you consider their counterterrorism efforts inadequate at this point?
Yes, totally inadequate. Just having a heavy-handed presence in a place does not make for effective counterterrorism. You have to be proactive, both militarily as well as in terms of economic as well as social palliative measures, as well as trying to reach out to the Uyghur population.
Hashim says there are many reasons for the rise of extremism in China. A lot of it, he says, has to do with social and economic discontent, along with a heavy security presence in Xinjiang. But he also says China is more open to outside influences, especially in Xinjiang, which borders more democratic Central Asian countries and is close to Islamic militancy in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Hashim also says China's military is not yet well-trained to deal with counterinsurgency, having long focused on high-tech state-to-state conventional warfare. After weeks of collisions between Chinese and Vietnamese fishing boats in a disputed area of the South China Sea, a Vietnamese boat has sunk. Shannon Van Sant reports from Beijing. China and Vietnam blame each other for the incident, with China asserting the Vietnamese boat was in Chinese waters.
Authorities said collisions Tuesday between Chinese and Vietnamese fishing vessels caused the sinking of a Vietnamese boat in the South China Sea, 30 kilometers from a Chinese oil rig based in contested waters. China's foreign ministry says Vietnam is to blame for the incident. Foreign Ministry spokesman Qin Gang says a Vietnamese fishing boat forcefully intruded in the area of China's oil rig and capsized after ramming a Chinese boat. He said Vietnam's dangerous actions were the direct cause of this incident, and China urges Vietnam to safeguard normal navigation and fishing activities on the sea. Vietnam says 40 Chinese fishing boats encircled and rammed a Vietnamese boat, causing it to sink. All 10 fishermen on the Vietnamese boat were rescued. Vietnam says the $1 billion Chinese oil rig is in its exclusive economic zone. China claims nearly all of the South China Sea and maintains the rig is in its territorial waters. China also announced the cancellation of some flights to Vietnam as tensions between the two countries continue to rise. During the past few weeks, violent protests in Vietnam against the oil rig resulted in the deaths of Chinese workers and looting of Chinese factories and businesses. Renmin University International Relations Professor Xiaohe Chong says both countries have violated a 2011 bilateral maritime pact. Less than 1 year ago, Chinese Premier Li Keqiang recommitted to that pact in meetings with Vietnamese leaders.
Both sides disregard the words and the spirit signed by Chinese Li Keqiang and Vietnamese leaders. And that's bad. That's bad not only for bilateral relationship, but also it's bad for the regional situations in Southeast Asia.
Many in China see Vietnam as historically a part of China and through online social media expressed support for China's actions in the South China Sea. Chung says today's tensions in the sea have roots in a battle over the Paracel Islands in 1974.
Yes, today's dispute has historical roots in what happened in 1974. Once a maritime military conflict between China and South Vietnam broke out, and the South Vietnam's actually fleet were almost annihilated by Chinese naval forces.
That dispute was the first Sino-Vietnamese naval battle in the South China Sea. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
The changing education landscape for international students. That's still to come on Daybreak Asia. Hong Kong appears to be heading toward greater political confrontation in the coming weeks. Pro-democracy activists are preparing to hold an unofficial referendum to pressure the territory's government and its superiors in Beijing to accept stronger democratic reforms. The Occupy Central Movement's referendum will ask residents whether they believe the public has the right to nominate candidates for the city's next leadership election in 2017. That is the first election in which Beijing has said the chief executive post can be filled by universal suffrage. Hong Kong chief executive Leung Chun-ying has criticized the referendum, telling lawmakers last week that he will not be pressured into implementing reforms that do not comply with the city's constitution or basic law. Leung and Chinese officials have said the basic law requires candidates to be nominated only by a committee and show loyalty to the Chinese motherland. The head of Hong Kong's pro-democracy Civic Party, lawmaker Alan Leung, rejects that interpretation. In our third and final part of this series, he spoke last week with Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin, who asked him whether he thinks the Hong Kong government can reach a compromise over the nomination process.
I think that is a right that goes with anybody's understanding of what genuine universal suffrage is. But to answer your question, I don't think the Central People's Government in Beijing or its agent in the form of Leung Chun-ying's administration in Hong Kong would be minded to give Hong Kong people the right to nominate and be nominated. And they would insist on pre-vetting candidates before their names could go onto the polling ticket. But the problem is that modus operandi would not give the 2017 chief executive the political legitimacy that this office needs badly to make Hong Kong governable.
Well, given the apparent tough line that Leung Chun-ying appears to be taking by warning the pro-democracy camp against pressuring him, how productive do you think it will be to keep up the pressure, and how much do you think can be achieved from the Occupy Central movement, which plans to block the streets of Hong Kong Island's central business district later this year if the government does not accept your demands?
Now, in fact, the Occupy Central movement has arranged for voting electronically and physically on the 20th, 21st, and 22nd of June for the people of Hong Kong to be able to cast a vote to indicate whether or not we insist on being our own real bosses and have a real choice in the 2017 chief executive election. Now, after 22nd of June, we can, of course, gauge the public support from the participants of that voting and the result of that poll. Now, hopefully, there would be a not insignificant number of Hong Kong people coming out to vote in June, and we can then be armed with that mandate from the people to start some negotiations with the Central People's Government. Now, what is at the heart of the disagreement between the Central People's Government and the people of Hong Kong is, of course, this civic nomination. In Hong Kong, people like me, a legislator, could be nominated by just 100 registered voters in my constituency, and that will be valid. So people will think why this kind of civic nomination would suddenly become unconstitutional, unlawful, etc., when it comes to the chief executive election. But what is behind all these calls for civic nomination is that we do not like the idea of pre-vetting candidates. So I think it is important for the Central People's Government to come round to realizing that the great majority of Hong Kong people are very pragmatic, we are practical, and we also love the country and love Hong Kong. So there is no need for you to actually vet out people who are on your blacklist and only allow Hong Kong people to vote on candidates which had been nominated by you. You see, this is a message to Hong Kong people that the Central People's Government simply does not trust Hong Kong people. And without that trust, it is very difficult to build a good rapport or relationship between the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region and the Central People's Government. I think the Central People's Government must understand that Hong Kong has peacefully and successfully reverted to Chinese sovereignty because of the promises enshrined in the Basic Law. If you now go back on what you have promised, then I don't think Hong Kong Special Administrative Region could be governable.
The head of Hong Kong Civic Party, Alan Leung, speaking with Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin. It is no surprise that higher education in the United States and worldwide is going through some major changes. These changes range from reduced funding for U.S. colleges and universities as they try to educate greater numbers of students about the implications of technological changes that have, in many cases, drastically changed the way students are taught and tested. In this week's report on education, Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman speaks with Molly Corbett Broad, the president of the American Council of Education. At a recent gathering of educators, she compared the changes reaching college campuses to the 1944 GI Bill in the United States, when returning veterans of the Second World War were given greater access to higher education. She called what is now happening as an avalanche of transformational innovation on a scale that has not been seen since the passage of that GI Bill.
The GI Bill tripled the number of American men studying in college, and the downstream impact of that growth in college graduates played a major role in the growth of the economy in the U.S. We are arguably in this kind of innovation, not just in teaching and learning, but also in scholarly research, probably the greatest change in our history since World War II. Leading to a dramatic expansion of opportunity that will serve people of all ages and all geographies.
Change is never an easy thing, especially in an area such as education, which relies so much on tradition. Is this a battle that's taking place?
Well, it certainly is a period of challenge for American higher education. I must say, college and university presidents in the U.S. are modestly optimistic about the future. They see that the additions in information technology and the uses of artificial intelligence and the emerging cognitive sciences are really opening up opportunities that will allow them to achieve very high quality, which is the key for professors, and defined uses of technology that would be comparable to the quality of the best professor is what the challenge is. But we are seeing evidence that artificial intelligence, cognitive science are opening up ways in which you can have high quality at a large scale and still have it customized to the individual student.
If you could, give me some examples that our audience can relate to.
So one example that comes immediately to mind are the various tests that we offer in the U.S. for admission to college, for example. And we now have the capability to have those tests be much more than multiple choice. They can be fill-in-the-blank, writing essays. They can be evaluated and machine-read while you are still at the testing site. If you did not pass every component of the test, you will get a diagnosis of what you missed, guidance that is very specific to workbooks and other materials that will help you prepare, and then you have the opportunity to take the test again. This is very high quality, but it's at a very significant scale.
What is your list of priorities as far as what must be done and what is being done?
At the top of the list would be to own the innovations that are unfolding and to leverage them in ways to advance the mission of higher education rather than trying to avoid the impact of the unfolding avalanche of transformation.
And you're optimistic, right?
I am very optimistic.
Molly Corbett-Broad, the president of the American Council of Education, speaking with Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman. If you would like to say hello to us, tell us what you think of our programs, have a suggestion, or just tell us about where you live, go to school, etc., you may by sending us an email to voaasia@voanews.com. We always enjoy reading listener notes like this one from a self-proclaimed super fan of Daybreak Asia. Hi, Jim. I'm a Chinese who's been listening to Daybreak Asia throughout my university years, and now, although I've graduated from university, I still follow your program. Recently, I've noticed that a new program called China Focus, which focuses on major events related with China, has been made, and I show huge interest in this program. I hope people from other nations will have a better and more comprehensive view of China and Chinese. Best regards, Dave Jung. Dave, we'll definitely be writing back shortly, and indeed, you are a super fan. Thank you for your nice comments. Beyond listening to Daybreak Asia and China Focus, we invite you to stop by our program pages at voanews.com/Daybreak Asia and /China Focus. Also on Facebook at VOA Asia, where you may share our stories, audio, and video with your friends. We're about to share with you the latest world news. It's up next with Steve Norman and International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA Chinese, and then look for VOA News Chinese Edition.